This is a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.
Welcome along. Hello, it is here, the Fun Kids Science Weekly. How are you doing? My name's Dan, right? I am your guide as we explore some of the most dangerous, weird, and wonderful things that are out there in the universe. Today, we'll learn about some of the most incredible inventions to ever take to the sky. Also, you can hear how there's an asteroid right now, currently hurtling really close to the Earth. That's a load of fun. It's on the way. And we'll chat to a man who climbs trees as a proper job. First, it's our Age of the Dinosaurs series. And today, one of the most scary and amazing ones ever. The T-Rex.
Imagine going back in time, not 100 years or 1,000 years, but millions of years. To the Age of the Dinosaur. Welcome to the end of the Cretaceous period, around 65 million years ago. Around this time, there were more dinosaurs than ever before. The world was crowded with groups of Triceratops, duck-billed Edmontosaurus, squawking birds, and a wide variety of plant and sea life. The end of the Cretaceous period is also where you'd find one of the best-known dinosaurs of them all, Tyrannosaurus Rex.
He's coming this way! Quick, run!
You'd definitely want to run from a T-Rex. His name means King of the Tyrant Reptiles. And he was a terrifying meat-eating dinosaur found in the continent that is now North America. This carnivore was massive at over 12 meters long and 6 to 7 tons in weight. He gouged at prey with his enormous jaws and his curved teeth made it hard to escape. Despite standing as tall as an elephant, T-Rex's brain wasn't much bigger than a loaf of bread. However, a cast from a fossilized T-Rex skull shows the parts in charge of his sense of smell were bigger than in other reptiles.
Ugh, what's that horrible smell?
That's the smell of rotting meat. A T-Rex could sniff out a carcass from over a kilometer away. It might not have been as tasty as fresh meat, but it was an easy meal.
Quick, another T-Rex is coming.
That's not a T-Rex, but it's still good to hide. That's a Tabasaurus batar, or T. batar. Tabasaurus came from Asia, not North America, but had a lot in common with T-Rex. They looked similar and were both top predators. Scientists think they're closely related, even though they lived on the other sides of the world. Some have even suggested that they might be the same species, but there were differences. Lab tests show that Tabasaurus had a less flexible jaw, so he might have preferred carcasses to hunting wriggling prey. And whilst T-Rex had eyes that faced forward, Tabasaurus had more sideways facing eyes.
Oh no, I think he's looking at me.
I think he's more interested in that herd of hadrosaurs over there. When hunting, he'd prefer to pick off the old, young, or sick members of a herd. But let's not hang about.
Paleontology. Pick.
The Age of the Dinosaurs came to an end 65 million years ago. It is thought that a giant asteroid 6 miles across smashed into the Earth, where the town of Chicxulub in Mexico now sits, triggering tsunamis and dust clouds that blotted out the sun. Plants could not grow. Animals were cold and hungry and began to die. From the seas to the skies, many creatures and plants disappeared forever. In fact, 7 out of every 10 species perished. The age of the dinosaurs had gone, and with it 200 million years of the most amazing creatures the world has ever seen. Thanks to paleontologists, we know much about what it was like. But there are many mysteries that remain. Maybe one day, you will make a new discovery yourself.
So that's it for our Age of the Dinosaurs series on this show for a while, but you can catch up on all the episodes you might have missed for free on the Fun Kids app, on iTunes, and over at funkidslive.com. We'll chat to a man with probably the best job ever in just a sec. First, I want to say a huge hello to Joe. Joe is six. He loves listening to the Fun Kids Science Weekly in the car with his dad. And he loves finding out about space, about science, about dinosaurs and the whole world, which is good. It's kind of what we're here for. And he's got a question. He wants to know, how do radios work? Well, Joe, if you stay right there, in a bit, we'll find out exactly why with Technomum. By the way, if you want a shout out on this show, just like Joe, it's really easy. Just get out your phone or your tablet, log on to the iTunes podcast store, and leave us a nice review while you're there. Say something about the show, drop us some stars, five if you fancy, leave your name, and then next week I might say hello to you. It's the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Our guest this week is James Aldred. He's a wildlife adventurer. He's the author of the book The Man Who Climbs Trees, and he's on now. James, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
So the book, The Man Who Climbs Trees, that's you. What makes you climb trees?
Well, apart from the fact that I love doing it and grew up doing it, it's primarily a way to get close to wildlife, particularly in the rainforest and the jungle. Most of the life in these places does actually live in the upper layer of the forest, in the canopy. And there's a whole world going on above our heads that when you trudge around in the dark of the forest floor, you just never get to see it. So as part of my job as a wildlife cameraman, I specialise in getting up onto those higher levels to try and catch an insight into the secret world.
So you, as a wildlife cameraman, what came first? Your kind of love of nature and your want to be around all kinds of animals, or wanting to film stuff and be behind a camera?
If I'm honest, I'm not really sure. It all started at quite a young age, but I would say it was probably the love of the wildlife that came first, quickly followed by the desire to try and communicate that through to other people, and predominantly my family at that stage. I just wanted to be able to kind of show them images and sort of get them to share the experiences I was having.
So the two things that you do in your job kind of fascinate me, so I thought we'd focus on them both individually to get some top tips. What is the best technique that you can give us for climbing trees?
Well, a lot depends on the species and the size of trees, but I know this sounds a bit dull and boring in these days of health and safety and all that, but it is kind of a good idea to get hold of a rope and a harness if you're going to go much more than sort of 15, 20 feet up in a tree. Having a rope and a harness, it opens up the tree completely. You can actually swing between branches. You can get to places that you simply cannot get if you're relying on your own 2 feet and hands. I would say that I always use a catapult. So actually fire a line up into a tree, so over a branch. You use that thin fishing line to then haul up your climbing rope. You tie up your climbing rope around the base of the tree, and then you jump on the other end, and that's what you climb. Once you're up in the canopy, to get around between the branches, you can reposition that rope, or you take up a second and even a third rope with you sometimes that you can then use to pretty much swing sort of Tarzan style between the branches. So that's the first thing I'd say is get a bit of experience and training in using that sort of kit. And so, then take it out to the woods.
So that's the tree climbing part of your job done. Also, as a wildlife cameraman behind the lens, what's the technique for filming these like rare, precious creatures so brilliantly?
It's all about being in the right place at the right time. Rather sort of frustratingly, what we think of being the right time is very rarely what an animal thinks of being the right time. You know, the more time that elapses without seeing the subject or without getting the behaviour you want, it's an investment. So it becomes harder and harder to then you know, sort of jack it in and go off and do something else, you know, because you've always got this little voice in the back of your head saying, oh, you know, you just know that they're doing everything up there right now. And this is the first day in 3 weeks you've decided not to be there. And, you know, so it's just being persistent with it, I would say.
So you've travelled all over the world to film these creatures really high up in kind of the top canopy of trees. Why are you going up there? What creatures are we missing that aren't down at ground level?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, a lot of the big iconic animals are at ground level. Elephants, you know, gorillas spend a lot of time on the ground. But really, really, they're still reaping the benefits of the life that's going on above. You know, they're eating fruit that falls from the high canopy. So if you want to be at the cutting edge, if you really want to be on the front line of life in a rainforest, you have to go to where the light is. And 95% of the light gets absorbed by the canopy before it even hits the forest floor. So that's where all the life is. So that's why you go up there.
And what creatures are you most proud of being close to in capturing on camera?
Well, the great apes are very, very spectacular and wonderful things to be close to. So things like orangutans, gorillas, chimpanzees, even silverback gorillas will climb high into the canopy sometimes. And that can be a very, very special thing to encounter. But I think also there are a lot of other animals which kind of slip under the radar, really, that a lot of people don't even know anything about. But I would say if the things that I'm most proud of being able to witness, to film in the past, I would say that harpy eagles is pretty high on that. Harpy eagle is a top predator in Central South America, and they eat monkeys. And they're famously secretive and aggressive and rare. So even if you're lucky to find one of their nests, it can be quite a challenge to actually get cameras up onto those nests because the parents automatically assume that you're there to actually harm their chicks, which you're not. So that was a very difficult job. I filmed them a few times on the nest, and that was hugely rewarding because we managed to get footage of chicks growing and feeding on the food that was being brought in by the parents, but no one had really ever seen before, and that was a lovely thing to do.
And you speak about harpy eagles being quite confrontational sometimes. How do other animals react if you've got silverback gorillas climbing up the trees? How do they find about a human kind of sticking a camera into their face?
Yeah, exactly. Well, they are individuals, and they do react very differently as individuals. For the most part, they're just curious and they want to come in and take a closer look. Things like harpy eagles are very different to any sort of bird is because they have a vested interest in one particular location. They've built a nest, they're feeding their chick, so they've put literally all their eggs in one basket, and the last thing they want is somebody disrupting that.
Now, as a cameraman, you had a big hand in one of the most famous kind of films that we've seen on a wildlife documentary on the telly, and that was, you had a hand with Sir David Attenborough, that famous shot of him being up near the canopy presenting TV at the top, yeah, of a tree. Tell us about, yeah, how you helped make that happen.
Well, David Attenborough is he's I think when we filmed that he was in his late 70s. So my role in that scenario was to rig the ropes ahead of his arrival. And I used the counterbalance system with what we call a bosun's chair, which is an ancient bit of technology derived from the old square rigger ships and the man of war from the Royal Navy, where the bosun would be lifted up into the rigging of these ships to inspect the rope work and to inspect the sails, etc. And I counterbalanced it with a large bag of dirt, basically, on the other side. So he sat in what was effectively a swing seat. The rope went up over a pulley, through the canopy of that tree to another pulley. This is all way, way, way up, 17, 18 stories off the ground. And then that rope continued down to a big lump of dirt, which almost exactly matched David's weight. The idea being that when I pulled down on the rope below that dirt, it hoisted David sort of effortlessly up into the canopy, and we could position him up a bit, down a bit, depending on the camera angle required.
Brilliant. I mean, I can't congratulate you enough for that. It's honestly one of the most amazing and awe-inspiring things. If you've not seen it on the internet, by the way, you need to check it out. Well, brilliant. James Aldred, the book is The Man Who Climbs Trees. James, thank you for coming on the Fun Kids Science Weekly.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much indeed.
Right, time for Dangerous Dan then, where we look at some of the most deadly, mean and evil things that are out there in the universe. This week, our creature has probably the scariest name of any animal ever. It's the Tarantula Hawk Wasp. So that's three pretty scary beasts in one name. They're found all over the world. The wasp, they fly about in Asia, Africa, Australia, in the United States. They're among the largest type of wasps as well, about 5 centimeters long. They've got a jet black body, and its name perfectly describes what it does. It's a wasp that hunts tarantulas. Now, I'll get to the brilliant way that it captures its prey in just a sec. But remember last week in Dangerous Dan, we spoke about the Schmidt Pain Index. Remember this? It's the way that scientists keep track of the most deadly stinging animals that there are. Well, the tarantula hawk wasp is the second thing on that pain index. Its sting is like an immediate, electric, excruciating shock. It lasts about 5 minutes. Now, thankfully, it doesn't cause any lasting damage to humans, but to its prey, it's deadly. And the way they capture tarantulas is just ridiculously amazing. A hawk wasp will paralyze a tarantula. It will inject into its belly a little wasp egg. Then the hawk wasp egg will hatch. A baby wasp will then eat its way out of the tarantula. It will munch its way through the stomach, rip the skin, until finally the wasp, now fully grown, has eaten all of the tarantula and it's reached the outside. So the tarantula hawk wasp has to be the most innovative, creative, and brutally destructive creature on our Dangerous Dan list. So we'll find out why an asteroid is currently hurtling past the Earth in just a sec. Also, you've got a chance to get your science question answered by our expert. First, let's catch up with another genius we know, Techno Mum. Right, she's a super brainy, technological wizard. She looks after you, she makes your dinner, and she can explain the point of the world. Today, she's telling us how radios work.
Techno Mum Fast Files.
I love a bit of radio. We all do in our family. Digital audio broadcasting, or DAB radio, is terrific technology because it's easy to pick the station you like. And there's a lot to choose from. But how does it all work? Well, first, the music from the radio station is turned into a digital code. A few bits of handy information are added, including the radio station's name, and it's all sent along cables to a computer. The computer is called a multiplexer, and it groups several radio stations together in a big bundle. This bundle of codes is then sent to a transmitter, which pushes the digital information into the air. Your DAB radio picks up the digital information and knows how to read the code. It turns it back into sound, neatly labelled up and ready for you to enjoy. If you've got a DAB digital radio, how many radio stations can you find on the menu?
Techno Mum, with the Institution of Engineering and Technology, advancing and sharing knowledge.
There you go, Joe. That is just for you, mate, to say thank you for sending us a review of the Fun Kids Science Weekly over on iTunes. That is also the place, by the way, that you can hear loads more Techno Mum for free. You can get it there on the Fun Kids app and over at funkidslive.com. Right, it's the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Let's put our expert's bulging brain to good use then. If you've got any sciencey question at all, by the way, it doesn't matter how silly, ridiculous, or kind of simple it may seem, you can send it over to my page at funkidslive.com and we'll get our expert Tom to answer it for you. Today's question, Tom, is from Alex, who is 8, who asks, how can water form balls in space?
I think the question Alex is asking here is from images on the space station where astronauts have water, they have coffee, and they pour it out the cup and it just forms a ball in front of them. The reason it does this is because of the surface tension of the water. It's also because the water molecules like being around each other. They fit together well. So combine that with the fact that the surface can hold itself and you get these balls.
So why do the water molecules like being around each other? Surely they don't have a brain, they're not conscious, they're not sentient. Why are they keeping together like that?
Well, it's not a conscious decision on their part. It's the bonds they have with each other. What we call a low energy state, it's its natural state, its best state, is together.
And talk to me about the surface tension. Why does that affect why water sticks together? For instance, if I was up in space on the space station, I saw a ball of water, if I prized it apart, would that work? Would it like it? What would happen?
If you prized it apart, then it would probably form two separate balls. So you'd require a bit of effort to get through the surface tension, but once you did, the water would then attract each other again and form two balls.
Let's see what sciencey stuff has been in the news this week. The largest asteroid in more than a century is due to pass by the Earth soon. Asteroid Florence measures 2.7 miles across. It's part of rubble left over from the formation of the Sun and the planets. And it's going to travel past the Earth 4.4 million miles away. You don't need to get too worried. Also, researchers have found evidence that humans may have reached South America around 21,000 years ago. They think that we travelled to Brazil to hunt giant sloths. And finally, computer scientists have developed a system that allows robots to understand what humans say, and it will allow them to follow orders to complete tasks. It's a bit like the Alexa box you might have in your lounge. It's a new technology that lets future robots do jobs for you. Now, while that is amazingly cool, it's also one step closer to our eventual job as human slaves to a bunch of robot overlords. So maybe let's not get too excited about that. Right, it's time to catch up with Amy Aviation then and learn more about some amazing inventions in the sky.
Amy's Aviation, with support from the Royal Aeronautical Society.
I'm at home experimenting on some more paper planes. Did you know that most paper planes have something in common with the space shuttle?
2, 1, 0, all engine running.
I know what you're thinking. Paper planes don't go into space. And you're right. But that isn't what they have in common. It's all to do with the shape of the wings. Many paper planes have, like, triangle-shaped wings, don't they? This is called a delta wing. So what, you might think? Don't all planes have wings that are the same shape? Well, no. Think about it. If you imagine the planes you get at a busy airport, the sort of planes you might go on holiday on, they don't have triangle-shaped wings, do they? Their wings stick out more sort of squarely on each side, don't they?
Ready for takeoff.
Your paper plane with its delta wings might fly quite well, but on real aircraft, delta wings aren't very good at low speeds. They're not very stable. But there's something delta wings are brilliant at, and that's flying super fast. Those large wings give the plane huge amounts of lift at high speeds and the ability to glide for thousands of miles. That's why the space shuttle had wings like this, and why it's a common shape on fighter jets too. There was even a famous passenger plane which had delta wings. You might have seen pictures of it. It was called Concorde and was the fastest passenger aircraft ever built. Many also think it was the most beautiful plane ever. It was sleek and dart-like with slim delta wings built smoothly around the long fuselage. It was so fast it could carry its passengers at supersonic speeds to New York from London in just over 3 hours. Supersonic means faster than the speed of sound. That's over 760 miles an hour. Although Concorde could cruise at over 1,000 miles per hour. Great if you're in a hurry, but there's a couple of big problems with all these delta wing planes. The first problem is that because they can be so unstable in the air, they can be really difficult to pilot. The smallest mistake could mean the plane would go into a spin, and that could mean a big crash. Luckily, most modern planes are fly-by-wire, which means that computers help take care of the difficult adjustments to keep the plane in the air. The second problem is that as they're made for speed, they need very long runways and have to go incredibly fast to take off and land. This can make them more dangerous. In 2000, a Concorde crashed when a tyre burst on takeoff. The high speeds may have contributed to this terrible disaster. Concorde were all retired in 2003. For lots of reasons, it just wasn't practical to use them for carrying passengers anymore. But they're a part of history we won't forget. Another incredible type of wing is the sort you get on a B-2, the stealth bomber. Now, this military aircraft has to be the weirdest looking plane you've ever seen. It's enormous and over 170 feet wide, totally black all over, and shaped like a big W, or like two W's. A giant flying zigzag, basically. It's seriously weird. And it's this shape because the whole plane is one big wing. There's no separate fuselage for the pilot and no tail fins. And why was it built this way? To make it virtually invisible. Okay, you're thinking, well, if it's an enormous big black W the size of half a football pitch, that doesn't sound very invisible to me. You'd be right, in a way. But it's on radar that it can barely be seen. When it's flying, if the enemy is scanning the sky with radar, its shape means that the waves bounce straight off, making it seem no bigger than a sparrow. So, next time you're making a paper plane, why not experiment with some different shaped wings? Time for me to fly! Chucks away!
Amy's Aviation, with support from the Royal Aeronautical Society. Find out more about aviation at funkidslive.com/aviation.
You can hear all the Amy Aviation episodes for free on your phone or tablet. Catch up on iTunes, on the Fun Kids app, and over at funkidslive.com. That's it for another episode of the Fun Kids Science Weekly. We're back at the same time next week. Remember, you can send in any question you've got. Doesn't matter how silly it might seem. Get it to my page at funkidslive.com. And if you want a shout out, you need to leave us a review on iTunes. And while you're there on iTunes, you can make sure you don't miss out on all of the brilliant science series we've got. They're on there, they're on the free Fun Kids app and on our website too. And you can hear and listen to Fun Kids all around the country on DAB digital radio, on the free Fun Kids app, and over at funkidslive.com.
So that was a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.